Welcome back to our web series, Acing a Tennis Career. We're really, really excited today because we have Katrina Adams in joining us on the show. Hey, Katrina. As you know, we're interviewing various people across the tennis industry who are sharing their stories with us, showing us what they've done in the tennis industry. And Katrina has a lot to tell us about. I'll give you a brief background about a little bit of what she has done, but she's going to give you more of the detail. And there is so much. Katrina Adams is a woman of many firsts, the first African-American to lead the United States Tennis Association, also the first two-term chairman of the USTA, and the first former player to hold that honor. Under the tutelage of the USTA, she received a whole lot of major milestones. Firstly, the opening of the 100 Court USTA National Campus in Orlando. I've been there. If you haven't, it's amazing. Then she did the transformation of the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, Flushing Meadows. You've all seen the US Open on TV. And then probably most importantly in my mind is the unprecedented outreach sort of effort into communities that haven't been exposed to tennis. And Katrina's particularly focused on that, to share the sport with more than just those champions. A little bit of background on Katrina. She attended Northwestern University, led her team to the Big Team Championship, also won the 1987 NCAA Doubles Championship, pretty huge. A familiar space with sports commentary, she played professionally, 12 years on the WTA Tour, 20 career double slam titles, I could go on and on. Been the leader on numerous federations, committees, philanthropic programs, just worked so hard for all of us. And I'm so excited for her to share more of her story with all of you today. Katrina, thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you, Natalie. Wow, that's a mouthful of what you just said. That's 20 doubles titles, not slams. I wish it was slams. But
yeah, okay. Maybe you a little bit me. More, but yes, doubles titles, a doubles title. Yeah. Katrina, just first of all, in the light of everything that's been going on in the world and in this country and in New York over the last few months, how are you feeling right now?
I'm tired. you know, it's been a rough year for me. I actually had COVID early on in March, a slight case of it. So I was very fortunate.
Thank goodness.
And, you know, exhausted for a week after having a couple nights of body aches. So not severe like many of the people that we've seen. Lost my dad in first part of May. Then now dealing with the, you know, the racial pandemic, it's been a lot.
There is a lot going on, but also very important times in terms of change and the potential influence that someone with your power and charisma has at this time.
Well, you know what, I've been very fortunate because I do have a voice with a lot of the things that are going on and trying to make sure that we are doing the right thing within our community and within our sport. So, you know, it's a good opportunity for everybody to look within to really make a valuable change.
I hear you. Let's go back a little bit, talk about your tennis career. When did you first pick up a racket?
So I started when I was six, the summer of my seventh birthday. And, you know, I was kind of a tag-along sister. The program was for 9 to 18-year-olds, and both my brothers were in the program. Of which they hate it, but that's what I had to do. And my parents were teachers. They taught summer school. So I tagged along with them and had to sit outside for 2 weeks to watch kids who had no interest in being out there, or just, you know, they were good, but I always felt that I was better, of course. And I hadn't even hit a ball yet. But I, you know, I was persistent and begged my way on to the court, into the program, and never looked back.
Oh, that's amazing. So we want to get to all sorts of bits, but let's talk a little bit about your time as a college player. Tell us how you felt about being, you know, balancing academics and sport and being a part of a team at university.
Well, there we go. Northwestern, go Cats. So, you know, I actually loved college tennis. I was very fortunate to get a full ride at Northwestern. You know, it was only 35, 40 minutes from where I lived. But I stayed on campus, lived the college campus life. But, you know, it was very interesting because I actually you know, growing up, I always admired Northwestern. I love purple. I love the Wildcats. Where one of the clubs that I practice at, the men's team practiced there because we didn't have our own facility on campus back then. The men practiced at one club, the women practiced at another club off campus. And so I always watched them and learned a lot about them, got to know the men's coach at the time as a teenager. And of course, the college coach was following me and keeping eyes on me. I won my Illinois High School State Championship my junior and senior year.
Yeah.
But I was a young senior. I was 16 when I graduated.
Wow.
And so the rest of the country didn't know that I was a senior and didn't know that I was eligible to be recruited or to go to college the following year. So I did not get recruited like I thought I would as a top junior in the country. But, you know, the Illinois schools knew that I was a senior because I was in the news and, you know, on the paper.
Lucky them.
Yeah. And so Northwestern was Sandy Stapp Clifton was really persistent, and I agreed to go there. So it was great. I had great fun. I built friends for life, both on the team and off the team. But, you know, you really got to understand yourself. You know, it's a really tough academic school.
Yeah.
So getting up, going to class, you know, after lunch, I'm going to practice where we had to drive 45 minutes away and practice for 2 hours and come back. So, you know, that's four hours out of my day running back to get some chow before studying in the evening and starting all over again. So you learn how to manage your time, which the sport of tennis teaches you anyways in managing your time and to be disciplined. But you know, it wasn't easy, and particularly when we had road trips and I had finals or other tests that I had to come back to. But you know what? It made me who I am today.
Thank goodness. Laid that foundation.
Exactly.
So did you know you wanted to go pro at any point in time or did it suddenly?
Yeah, it was a goal of mine. A lot of people thought I would turn pro after I graduated from high school. That was never crossed my mind. It was not an intent. I always knew that I wanted to go to school for at least 2 years because I knew I was on the verge of, I had the talent to go pro. And then after my first year, the college coach thought that I was going to turn pro. And I was like, I never said that. I'm coming back. And so she was pleased. But somewhere during the second year, she thought it was time. She knew where my talent had gone. You know, my partner, Diane Dowley, and I were undefeated at that point. Of the year, and we went the entire season undefeated, winning the
wow.
national championship. And so that was a testament, and you know, it was a sign for me to say, okay, it's time to move forward. So I actually ended up playing summer challengers and the ITF Pro Circuit or USCA Pro Circuit at the time as an amateur. And then I met with my coach and athletic director to find out if I could take the fall quarter off, play as an amateur to continue to see if this is something I really wanted to do or was good enough to do. And if my ranking got high enough, I would turn pro in January. If not, I'd come back to school, keep my scholarship and never have the discussion again. But I rose to be 104 on the rankings and got directly into the Australian Open. And then that was the start of my professional career.
And then you played 12 years?
I did. 12 years through 99. I played singles through the beginning of my last singles tournament, I think, was February of 1998. And then I played doubles only the rest of 98 and 1999.
So if you look at those 12 years, what was the biggest thing that tennis gave you, would you say, over those years?
Well, it obviously gave me an education on life. You know, the life experiences that I learned traveling around the globe, you know, when you go into this sport as a professional, you immediately become an adult, you know, you're your own CEO and you have to figure out how to manage your enterprise, which is yourself. And so I was able to learn a lot about myself, how to manage my time, my finances, et cetera, and traveling, competing, understanding who's in your corner, who's not in your corner. But building lifelong relationships, you know, with some of the greatest players of all time and greatest administrators of all time. And, you know, that's the network that you develop and build that you carry with you for the rest of your life?
That sort of set the sort of basis for your ability to move into business. But was it an easy transition, turning from being a professional tennis player and moving into the business world?
Well, you know what? It was. It took time. It wasn't something that I went into directly. When I stopped competing, I became a national coach and I actually worked for the USTA for about four and a half years. And as a national coach, I had to learn how to manage my own budget, my travel schedule, managing kids, et cetera. So that wasn't easy. That was definitely new to me, but you figure it out. And you get some assistance along the way. So that was probably the first step outside of my own professional career of understanding business and having meetings, et cetera. And then I went into commentating. And again, you got to manage, you know, I didn't have an agent, so it's negotiating my own deals with the networks, et cetera. But it was really not until I became the executive director of the Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program did business come into play. So now I'm the executive director and I'm managing a staff, you know, I'm setting strategic direction for the program, meeting with the board, getting direction from them. And that just kind of evolved. You know, became a board member of the USTA and started to learn more about the USTA as a whole from a grassroots perspective and not just from a competitive perspective. And that's when I realized that tennis was so much greater than just playing tournaments and having a ranking. And that grassroots tennis really mattered. I grew up in a grassroots program, so I know the benefits from it. So for me to come and run HJTEP, you know, that was my chance of giving back, to reach back and bring forward and opportunities for these young kids that, you know, many people gave me when I was coming up. And that's how the transition started and just evolved from there.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because the USTA is comprised of like competitive and community-based. And as you say, not a lot of people know that. You became the USTA chair, the youngest person to lead the USTA, and the first woman of color. So you had this choice of like deciding where you wanted to focus all of the USTA sort of powerhouse.
Right.
And how did you balance both of those? Because you elevated the game on both sides and you kept both priorities. But how did you work that through?
Well, you know, the good thing about the USTA is that it's ever evolving. And so I came in probably at a really good time when on the professional side where things were going great and getting stronger. You know, when you look at what we do from a grassroots level of putting rackets in hands, creating programs and opportunities for everybody to get in the game, you know, that was the thing that attracted me the most of the intent of the USTA and how we were going about doing our business. So, of course, for me, growing up in the parks and playing the junior circuit, playing high school tennis, collegiate tennis, professional, et cetera, I brought a wealth of experience and knowledge with me to be able to go out and articulate and communicate with the powers that be around the nation to buy in to what we were doing. And so, you know, the biggest thing when I came in, you know, I wanted to focus on growing tennis in the Hispanic communities, communities that we don't see a lot of tennis players coming from. And there are a lot of athletes in these communities, but you have to understand how to communicate with them because, you know, we're known to send the wrong messenger in with the message. And you got to send the right messenger in with the right message. So all of these Hispanic and Latino communities have different cultures. So you have to understand what's important to them to be able to communicate it and articulate it to get them to buy into what you're looking for, to engage them into our sport. And I think we did a really good job of that initially and early on in trying to grow tennis in those communities. But also I wanted to kind of change the culture of sportsmanship within the USTA and the behaviors that we were seeing, not just from the players on court, but really the adults, the parents that were involved and officials, and getting them to understand that this is a sport, you know, it's supposed to be fun and it's supposed to learn good behavior and good sport in it. And it had gotten way too volatile, really, in a lot of instances. So that was it. And I wanted to grow the base of our high school players, because many of our high school players around the country played double sports, right? They played tennis this season, they played something else the next season, and they really weren't spending a lot of time in developing their tennis skills. So, you know, we spent a lot of time and energy on making opportunities more accessible for them within their local clubs and communities to play more tennis outside of high school tennis, to hopefully keep them in the sport. Not everybody's going to be a professional tennis player, right? But it's a sport for a lifetime. It's one of the healthiest sports that you can be in. But you can go into the business of tennis and not be a tennis player. So no matter what your discipline is and your background, there is a tennis business that you can go in. So whether it's in finance, whether it's legal, whether it's in IT, marketing, whatever those positions, professions may be, there's a position somewhere, not just at the USTA, but, you know, at the sectional level and other entities within our sport.
Yeah, it's like a huge spider web. I mean, I'm a TSR, so I'm right down on the ground at the grassroots level, and you're up here, and there's so many opportunities in between. On a day-to-day basis, sort of who are you working with out there to kind of grow tennis?
Well, right now I'm not the leader anymore. So most of my time is focused at the Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program, working with tennis service reps like yourself, TSRs, and making sure that we have the resources necessary to keep our program successful, running it and successful and providing these opportunities on the grassroots level. On the other extreme, I'm the vice president of the International Tennis Federation, the ITF, which is global. And so I had a board call this morning, actually. We're trying to make sure that tennis is accessible globally, and making sure people are playing. But, you know, with the COVID pandemic right now, it's been very challenging for any of the competitions here locally, in the U.S. and in our metro area and eastern section, et cetera. And you can only imagine that the entire world shut down. So there's no competitive tennis going on anywhere. But how do we get back into it safely to make sure that people can enjoy the sport the way that they have in the past, and probably even more so now, because when something's taken away from you, you learn to appreciate it that much more when you go back into it. And I'm hoping that will go viral, if you will, with everyone getting back on the court soon.
Well, I read something the other day that said Wilson have recorded that they've had higher levels of tennis sales than ever before, particularly rackets for beginners. So I thought that was really good news.
Yeah, I've spoken to probably 6 or 7 people in the last month or so to say that they had taken up tennis. There's a court that's right down the street from me, and I'd never used it. So, you know, we got a couple rackets in and went out and started playing. It's pretty cool. Balls are flying everywhere, but I'm having a lot of fun and getting a great workout. And, you know, maybe I'll take up lessons once we can get back. And I'm like, that's awesome. And that's what it's, you know, and that's what it's all about. So I think we probably have attracted some new interested players during this pandemic, but we want to keep them in the, we want to keep them in the sport, because once they're able to go back to work, that free time that they've had to go out and play now, you know, is going to start to shrink.
But tennis is easy. It is quick. And there's normally a park just down the road. So at least it's accessible. I heard Tiger Woods the other day saying, well, they said, what have you been doing during lockdown? And he was saying, I've been playing a ton of tennis and I haven't had so much fun in a long time.
So, I missed that one. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So it's great.
So let's move away from the USTA for a minute and look at your track record in terms of innovation, collaboration. You've been vice president of the International Tennis Federation, you just talked about, the ITF, chairman of the Fed Cup Committee, chairman of the Gender Equality and Tennis Committee, executive director of the Harlem Junior Tennis, which you've referenced, and you've branched into the private sector's board of member and audit committee chair of the Pivotal Acquisition Corp, and advisory board member of Athletics Unlimited. So that's a lot. If we just think of all of those and just think, what are the biggest challenges out of being part of these committees and federations? And then what have been your most rewarding moments in terms of where you feel you've had a huge impact?
Well, I don't commit to do anything if I don't feel that I'm going to make a difference and be impactful. So anything that I'm on a board or advisory board or what have you, it's because I truly feel that my presence and my participation is going to be an asset to that organization. So, you know, the latest one is Athletes Unlimited, which is a women's sports pro league that's going to be run very differently. And we're starting with softball. The league starts in Rosemont, Illinois, right out of Chicago. It's from mid-August to mid-September. And they're all going to play at one location. In Parkway Bank Park in Rosemont. And, you know, and the players are going to be on different teams every day, playing with each other today and against each other tomorrow. And the salary is based, you know, they'll have a base, and then they'll be able to actually earn proceeds once there's revenue sharing afterwards. So it's very interesting to me and to see that professional sports can go beyond tennis and basketball and soccer as we know it today. The ITF obviously is the global, you know, they manage the sport globally, and to be able to be a part of that position on the board and, you know, to be recognized and feel that I can make a difference, and hopefully I have. I was reelected in 2019, so I'm in my fifth, going on sixth year on this board. And, you know, it's challenging. It's challenging because there's just so much to accomplish. And by being on that board, I'm the chair of that gender equality in tennis committee, as well as the Fed Cup committee. And really, we like to call it GET, hashtag GET. You know, it's really focusing on getting more women involved in our sport, not so much as a tennis player, but to get more involved on the business side, on the volunteer side, to join committees, to be able to be on boards and to be in the executive offices, and wanting our young ladies that are grow up playing tennis, go to college, they're not playing in college, you know, they're recreational players, et cetera, but that really have an affinity for the sport. When they graduate from college, they're looking to get engaged on the business side of the sport, because we need more women voices in these rooms. We need more diversity of thought in these rooms, in these meetings, and that's really the focus of it. And when you're talking about a global committee, there's so many countries where women don't have voices yet, or just starting to get a voice. And so really trying to navigate that has been very interesting, but at least there is conversation, which has never been had in many of these regions and countries. So I'm pretty passionate about that, and I wanted to make a difference. And it's called gender equality, but it's really about equality, period, for people, because the platform and the pillars that are in place about empowering and having one voice and having balance is extremely important in everything that we do, you know, across the board.
You've also just written a book called Own the Arena. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it comes out in March of 2021. It was supposed to be released in July next month. But of course, because of the COVID pandemic, I didn't have the ability to go around and talk about the book or to promote the book, to do book signings, you know, after it's released, et cetera. So it was best to push it back or forward, push it back until next year. And hopefully, you know, in a healthy environment to be able to promote it. But it's Own the Arena, making a difference and succeeding as the only one. That only one that we talk about, as you mentioned, is the African-American in the room, on the board, as a chair, often the only woman in the room, in these boardrooms and in these meetings, et cetera. And teaching people how to navigate being in those situations as the only one, whatever that might be for you, and owning your voice and your owning the room that you're in and having that confidence, but even more so being prepared. And so I kind of use the life lessons that I've learned through tennis, and how it's prepared me for every stage of my life to feel confident and have that ownership of the things that I do to make a difference.
I can't wait to read it. March seems a long way away. Can't you bring it forward?
You know, it'll be here before you know it, because we're already in June, and I swear it was just March yesterday.
Feels like that's true. So you've also received some significant recognition. You've been named Adweek Magazine's most powerful woman in sports twice, 2016-2017, Forbes Magazine's most powerful woman in sports list in 2017, and Ebony's Magazine's Power 100 list. So going forward, you know, what do you want to do with this power that you have for positive change? Where are your goals oriented right now?
Yeah, I don't know about the power, but you know, it was an honor to be, listed, you know, on those lists while I was a chair and president of the USTA, which also made me the chair of the US Open. So I think that had a lot to do with being named. But it's an honor. I mean, I sit on boards and councils with some of the most powerful men and women in sport to share ideas and talk about change. One of the boards I sit on is RISE, the Ross Initiative for Sports Equality, which focuses on fighting racism and bigotry and teaching our young people the tools necessary to overcome racism and bigotry and how to navigate in those environments and teaching them right from wrong. And every leader of every sports league and every sports television network sit on this board. And so that's a pretty powerful group of people. And, you know, we're hoping to make change. And, you know, and then we deal with what's happened to Mr. Floyd and a lot of other issues that have been brought to light in a couple of weeks. And we realize that that board, even more so, is so vital in today's society. But, you know, the power is about having the platform to speak the truths and to bring awareness to those that may be ignorant in certain subjects and conversations. And that's what I will continue to do. I don't commit to do anything if I don't feel that I'm not going to be impactful and make a difference somewhere down the road. And that's where my life has put me in those positions through the sport of tennis to have those opportunities.
And you talked about being the only person in the room. And I think that conscious level of building awareness of people noticing that sort of thing. I end off these interviews always saying to people, who do you think, I'm going to ask you a quick question. And one of my questions is, who do you think is going to win the US Open this year? And on the whole, most of the men give me a male and most of the women give me a female. And that's just a frame of reference on a subconscious level in terms of their personal familiarity and interest. And I think a lot of it starts just making people realize, like, do you realize there's a men's and a women's Open final? You know, it's a simple example, but there's a lot of that conscious level awareness that we need to work towards.
No, it's true, because when I'm asked that question, I always say who I think is going to win on the men's side and the women's side. And I typically start with the women, but because I'm like, that's what the US Open is. It's not just one event. And I could go further and even talk about who I would think for the doubles and mixed doubles. But on the whole, when people ask you that question, they're referencing the singles.
Yeah. And that's interesting in itself. So much of where the potential lies in terms of change and you working in that area is to broaden people's awareness of these subtle biases that we have that we don't even realize that we have. I'm not going to ask you who's going to win the US Open. I'm going to ask you another question. Two questions, actually. One is that a lot of people, when I've asked them if they could change one thing about tennis, have said they'd like to have coaching on the court. Do you have an opinion on that, or are you willing to reserve your opinion for now?
Yeah, no, I definitely have an opinion. I think when the conversation first came about, I used to say, oh, no, you know, we can't have coaching. This is a one-on-one sport. It's a gladiator sport, blah, 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 blah. But then, you know, as you really look into it and you watch, you observe, at the end of the day, no matter what you tell me to do, I still have to go out and execute it. So, you know, having that coach to make you just maybe slow down and think about what you're doing a little bit more, or maybe bring attention, you still have to go out and execute. So I don't disagree with having coaching. The USTA has actually been an advocate for coaching at the Grand Slams for the last 2 or 3 years. We've utilized it in qualifying and in doubles, and it just never made it to the singles. And that's a bigger conversation between the Grand Slam tournaments and chairman. But yeah, I think it'd be great.
Make it interesting.
Yeah.
My last question to you, how would you like tennis to evolve over the next 2 to 5 years? What's the biggest change you'd like to see or exciting opportunity that you'd like to have emerge?
I just want to see, you know, the opportunities to be equal for both men and women, boys and girls, whether it's the number of events that are available for our youth that are competing and being able to play more locally than having to travel all the time to compete and earn you know their rating, their rankings. I think on the professional side, obviously prize money equality. We're equal at the Grand Slams, but the tours are not equal. And too often our men and women are playing at the same location for different prize monies, which is very confusing for the fan when they're looking at it. And it's, you know, we're all out here making a living, working hard and doing all the same things. And TV is tuning into us and fans are tuning into us. So it's time that we have an even playing field, not only an even playing field, but an even paying field.
Katrina, thank you so much for coming onto our show. I'm sure all the viewers will be so excited to have heard from you, and keep healthy and well. We look forward to seeing you out there in person, hopefully not too long before everybody's able to mix in person again.
Wonderful. Thank you, Nat. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.